Blog Talk Radio.
And good morning. Welcome to another episode of Quest Youth Radio. This morning is special because this is the weekend that marks the 57th anniversary of the March on Washington in 1963, which was headed by A. Philip Randolph and Martin Luther King and other important individuals during that particular civil rights movement in that period of time during that era. Without any further ado, I'd like to say that our particular goal is to make waves. And by doing that, we start with our quest moment. A cornucopia of physics dictates that where there are vibrations, there must be a medium. And all vibrations possess a wave nature. In our community, our art is, in fact, and in spirit, the medium through which our waves travel. Where there is no medium, there are no vibrations. Let's make some waves. Mr. Harris, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. How's everybody? Oh, all right. So before I begin, let me give a shout out to a brother who, in his short time on this planet, has done a lot of positive things. I'm talking about Chadwick Boseman, you know, who transitioned into an ancestor yesterday. And just shout out to him and his family for what they're going through. And I needed to say that first. Change of events reveals the interpretation of one event to another. Now, we have a lot of division and stuff in our country that's going on right now where both sides are claiming the same thing, where both sides think, well, this is what America is really about, and both sides claim to be patriots, and both sides feel like they're fighting for their cause, which is the only cause. But there was a poem written in 1936 by Langston Hughes called Let America Be America Again. And he wrote this poem while he was riding on a train from New York to Ohio, and he was just reflecting on his life during the Depression. And in this poem, he describes how disillusioned he was about the American dream and suggests that the United States had failed to fulfill the promise of freedom and equality for all people. Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plain seeking a home where himself is free. America was never America to me. Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. Let it be the great, strong land of love, where never kings convene and nor tyrants scheme, that any man can be crushed from one above. It was never America to me. Oh, let my land be the land where liberty is crowded with the false patriotic grief. But opportunity is real and life is free, equality in the air we breathe. There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this homeland of the free. Say, who are you that mumbles in the dark? And who are you that draws your veil across the stars? I'm the poor white, fooled and pushed apart. I'm the Negro bearing slavery scars. I'm the red man driven from the land. I'm the immigrant clutching the hope I seek and finding that the same stupid plan of dog eat dog, of mighty crush the weak. I'm the young man full of strength and hope, tangled in that ancient chain of profit, power, gain, of grab the land, of grab the goal, of grab the ways of satisfying need, of work the men, of take the pay, of owning everything from one's own greed. I'm the farmer, the bondsman to the soil. I'm the worker, sold to the machine. I'm the Negro, servant to all of you. I'm the people, humble, hungry, and mean. Hungry, yet despite the dream, beaten, yet today. Old pioneers, I am the man who never got ahead, the poorest worker bartered through the years. Yet, I'm the one who dreamt our basic dream in the old world while still a serf of kings. Who dreamt the dream so strong, so brave, so true, that even yet is mighty daring signs in every brick and stone, in every furrowed turn that made America the land it became. Oh, I'm the man who sailed those early seas in search of what I meant to be my home. I'm the one who left the dark Ireland shore, the Poland plain, the English grassy lea, and torn from Africa's strand, I came to build the homeland of the free. The free? Who said the free? Not me. Surely not me. The millions on relief today, the millions shot down when we strike, the millions who have nothing for our prey. For all the dreams we've dreamed, all the songs we've sung, all the hopes we've held, all the flags we've hung, the millions who have nothing for their pay, except a dream that almost dead today. Oh, let America again be America, the land that never been yet, and yet must be, the land where every man is free, the land that's mine, the poor man, Indians, Negro, and me. Who made America? Whose sweat and blood, whose faith and pain, whose hand at the foundry, whose plow in the rain must bring back our mighty dream again? Sure, call me any ugly name you choose. The steel of freedom doesn't stain. But those who lived it like leeches on the people's lives, we must take back our land again. Oh, yes, I planned it. I said it plain. America was never America to me. Yet I swear its oath that America will be. Out of the rack and ruin of our gangsters' death, the rape and rot of graft, stealth, and lies, we the people must redeem the land, the mines, the plants, the rivers, the mountains, and the endless plain, all that stretch across these green states, and make America, America again. The fact that he wrote this back in 1936 is a reflection of the same, these are the same issues that people are talking about today with this Black Lives Matters, with this we need to do something about police brutality, we need to stop letting the 1% do the things to us that we've been allowing. And thought it was very pertinent for what's going on today to see that the struggle continues.
I hear what you're saying. I think the poem was great, but stop doing the things, your statement, stop doing the things that we've been allowing. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, you know, like you said, when it comes to our people, we outdo anything that we put our minds to. If we're going to be a patriot, we're going to be the super patriot. You know, just like in religion, if we're going to be a Baptist, we're going to be the best Baptist. We're going to be the best of whatever we do, because that's where naturally our spirit takes us to that level. But when you're dealing with people who don't have that same mindset, that sometimes they take your kindness for weakness. And, you know, and it seems like we keep doing the same thing, asking the same questions, and expecting something different to happen. This is not the way here. It's not the way in America. America has always been what America is. Maya Angelou once said, once a person shows you who they are, believe them. And we don't seem to have reached that point where we believe that America is just who it is.
Okay. Thank you again for that pertinent chains of events segment. And I'd like to ask you, curtains. It's time.
Yeah, because curtains kind of it picks the it's an analysis basically of artists and their work in front of and behind the curtain. Today our curtain is going to be talking about a young brother, well, relatively young, depending on who you're talking to, who's been doing a lot of things since a young age. And this brother is Wynton Marsalis. He's an internationally known musician, composer, band leader, educator, and a leading advocate of the American culture, which jazz is the only true American art form that was started here in this country that's been spread around the world. He was born in New Orleans in October in 1961, and at an early age, he exhibited a special talent in playing the trumpet. By the age of 14, he performed with the New Orleans Philharmonic. And at 17, he was the youngest member to be admitted to Tanglewood's Berkshire Music Center. This is a really prestigious place. And despite his youth, he was awarded their highest award for a brass instrument from a student. And, you know, he subsequently left New Orleans and moved to New York to attend Juilliard in 1979. That's when he started moving around and start what they say, gigging around the city. And one of the places where he really got his real start is in 1980, where he seized the opportunity to join the Jazz Messengers to study under the master drummer and lead band leader, Art Blakey. And it was from Art Blakey that he went and acquired his concept for band leading and for bringing intensity into each and every performance. During that time, in those years, he played with Sarah Vaughan, Dizzy Gillespie, John Lewis, Sonny Rollins, Ron Carter, Herbie Hancock, Tony Williams, countless other jazz musicians. But what people seem to not understand that he started out as a classical musician. He loved the music of Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart. And his first album he recorded was a classical record that won a Grammy at the end, and he was only 20 years old. You know, and he did 10 other classical musics, all to critical acclaim. You know, he played with the Boston Pops, the Cleveland Orchestra, the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. You know, he was definitely a man around town. He was real crafty with his instrument. You know, he, of all the like awards and accolades, he got a lot of them. He won 9 Grammys. You know, he was the only person, the only artist to win a Grammy on both the jazz and classical categories, and repeated that a couple of times. And today, still, he's the only one to win a Grammy in 5 consecutive years. You know, his honorary degrees, they go on and on, you know, but in 1987, he co-founded a jazz program at Lincoln Center. During this, because of his success, jazz at Lincoln Center was installed as a new constituent of the Lincoln Center program, equal to the stature of the New York Philharmonic, the Metropolitan Opera, and the New York City Ballet. And this was big for jazz as an art form and for the Lincoln Center as a cultural institution. In 2004, with the assistance of the board and staff, he opened the Frederick P. Rose Hall, the first institution of jazz. The complex contains 3 state-of-the-art performance centers, including a concert hall, a recording studio, and a broadcast and rehearsal studio. Whitney Marcellus was devoted to his life of upbringing the people around the world with the spirit of jazz. His whole body of work was enough to fill 2 lifetimes. He continues to work endlessly to contribute even more to the world's cultural landscape. It's been said that he's an artist whose greatness is not possible but inevitable. The most extraordinary dimension of Whitten, however, is not his accomplishments, but his character. He is less known for part of this man who finds endless ways to give of himself. Whitney Marcellus has selflessly donated his time, talent, and nonprofit organizations throughout the country and to raise money to meet the needs of our society. From My Sister's Place, a shelter for battered women, to Grand Wyndham, a shelter for homeless children, to the Children's Defense Fund, Amnesty International, the Sloan Kettering Cancer Institute, Food for All Seasons, a food bank for the elderly and disadvantaged, and very special arts, an organization that provides for experiences in dance and drama, literature, and music for individuals with physical and mental handicaps. To the North Boys Choir, a full-time education academic music school for disadvantaged youth. The Hugs Foundation, Help Us Give Smiles, provides for lifetime-changing surgical procedures of children with cleft lip. You ever seen people whose lips are all jacked up? He was part of the foundation that helped doctors go around the world to help fix them. And he responded enthusiastically to the call for service. And William Marcellus' commitment for the improvement of life to all people portrays the best in his character and his humanity. And he has a slew of honorary doctorates from Brown University, Boston College, University of Miami, Hunter College. It goes on and on and on. The brother has been doing a lot of stuff in front of where he's been doing things that nobody ever does in the area of music. And behind the scenes, he understands, I guess from his humble upbringings in New Orleans, that he understands that you got to give something to get something. And, you know, so that was really important to me to pick him as our curtain for today.
Yeah. There's a saying, for those where much is given, much is required. And that long list of philanthropic endeavors to actually help other people is what Curtains is really all about. Because, you know, just like the segment introduction talks about, a lot of times we have many entertainers and musical artists that make millions of dollars and have received all sorts of awards, but yet have a short list of contributions to humanity and the people who have made them popular and famous, if that applies.
And Wynton is an epitome of that character of a person that needs to be recognized in those areas.
Okay. All right. So we're going to keep it moving. And now it's time for Walter, our student host, and we need to get him in there. Walter, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Bay, and good morning to everybody out there. So for our first segment of the day, the first of two diamonds, and the intro for diamonds is history is like a diamond. Each prism represents the work of a group of people at a particular period of time. Look into the diamond and see the reflections of your past self, the pain of your mother, the choice of your father, and the blood of your ancestors to find yourself. Now, today's diamond will be on Jesse Jackson. It starts by saying, "Ladies and gentlemen," says the announcer, "I would like to introduce a man who will be the 1984 Democratic nominee for President of the United States, Reverend Jesse Jackson." Everyone clapped and cheered. Jesse proudly stepped to the front of the platform. He raised his arms and gave the V, sign for victory. History was being made. In 1984, Jesse Jackson became the first black man to run for president. Few people in Jesse's hometown could have imagined how important he would become. When he was young, many children teased him because his mother wasn't married when he was born. But Jesse always knew he became an outstanding, always knew he was a special person. He was determined to succeed. In high school, he became an outstanding football player and school leader. During the 1960s, Jesse joined the Civil Rights Movement. He became a member of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC, and worked closely with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. In 1967, he gained a wide power and respect when he was appointed Director of Operations, a program that helped a large city obtain jobs and housing. A year later, Jesse became a minister. In 1971, he organized Operation PUSH, Peoples United to Save Humanity. This organization is still fighting for equality for all. In 1988, Jesse ran an even stronger campaign to gain all the Democratic nominations for president. He won a number of states and finished second in many others. Some people were surprised by the support he received. Although he did not win, Jesse Jackson has risen from the humble beginning to become one of the most powerful men in America. Thank you. And
yeah.
I guess the reason is because of his he still, of course, Jesse Jackson is still alive to this day. And he has been very vocal and very outgoing of the situation that has been going on recently with Jacob Blake. And on Milwaukee, he's spoken on that. He's spoken on other deaths that happened all these past years to police brutality. So even Jesse Jackson, who already had a successful run, is still going to this day in his elder years, and still fighting and still pushing. This shows how important and determined he is to make a change in society. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. When Jesse Jackson ran for president, I actually got on the bus, or in a van, in fact, and drove down to Atlanta, Georgia for the first time in my life for a campaign fundraiser and speech by Jesse Jackson when he was running for president. And I find one of the controversial things about his candidacy and running for president during that time period was the fact that he was endorsed by Louis Farrakhan. And what an uproar and a stir throughout this country for him to receive and accept an endorsement from Minister Louis Farrakhan. It was just something that I'll never forget. And I just wanted to, interject that in there. Good job, and please continue.
Yes, and for the second diamond of today, I will be switching over to the music side of things, and I will be talking about Mahalia Jackson. Now, the little girl with the big voice started singing in her Sunday school choir before she was 5 years old. By the time she left New Orleans for Chicago in 1927, Mahalia Jackson, at age 16, had already sung in church many of the songs that would later make her famous. Mahalia's childhood dreams were becoming a nurse, not a singer, but she went to Chicago to attend nursing. But life there was not easy. Working as a washerwoman, she barely had enough money for room and board. Tuition for nursing school was out of the question. It was a depressing time for Mahalia, but her church activities helped her through it. Just as her church in New Orleans had been the center of her life, so too was her church in Chicago, the Greater Salem Baptist Church. There, Mahalia became involved with the gospel singing of groups formed by the minister's son. Mahalia was so good, she soon began performing and touring alone. The deep, rich quality of Mahalia's voice, a quality that moved to tears almost everyone who had heard her song, attracted many people. This included the managers of the recording studio in Chicago, who paid Mahalia $25 for her first song in 1934. That year was the fifth year of the Great Depression, a time when most people had little money. So $25 was a fortune of Mahalia. In 1946, Mahalia recorded Move On Up a Little Higher, a song that made her famous and earned her a real fortune, $100,000. Soon, she was appearing in concerts at home and abroad. Actively involved in the struggle against racial injustice, Mahalia met Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and Reverend Ralph Abernathy, who asked her to sing at a civil rights rally in Montgomery, Alabama. In 1955, this was the beginning of a close association with Dr. King in the civil rights movement. And until her death, Mahalia donated her time, money, and talent to the struggle for a better America. Thank you.
Okay. That is a voice that has resonated from the past into the future. And what particularly motivated you to choose her as a diamond this morning?
Again, just to give notoriety to Mahalia Jackson, because I still believe that she is not also talked about, which how she contributed to the movement and to America on the music side of things. You know, she grew up a gospel singer. She made her living, and she was able to provide for America through gospel. And that God, you know, everybody knows gospel music can help bring people together through a tough time. And she has done that with her music and also money donating and helping America.
Right, right. You know, Negro spirituals have played a powerful role in our history here in America. And Mr. Harris always reminds us that it is the music that has followed the pace in this place we call America. As you continue, Walter, the stage is still yours.
Yep, and I will be going on to my next segment of the day, which is definition. And definitions. This segment provides the listener with words and their meanings so that we can achieve together a common basis to say we care and we believe in ourselves. Remember, whoever controls our definitions controls us. We must define existence and not have it defined for us. And today's definition is a definition we did in the past, but it's a definition that we need to reinstate and talk about again, which is resilience. Resilient is a person who is able to withstand or recover quickly from bad conditions. Now, relating resilience to today or to a situation, you know, sports players. A lot of the top athletes are able to recover quickly or recover from a bad play or a little injury, a bad injury, or, you know, just something bad that affects the game. The best people are able to recover from that and to able to keep pushing through to help their team or help themselves. There's also resilience with African Americans. For the past 400 years, I've always come across a challenge and an obstacle that they have to fight back and bounce back if we want to achieve the main goal, which is equality and for everybody to be together. We had to be resilient. There was multiple times where, you know, we could have just gave up. It looked like there was no hope. But, you know, what kept us going was that resilience. And that will to want to keep continuing the movement and continue to strive in America. Because of course, before some people probably didn't think, oh, they didn't know when slavery was going to end. Then finally the Civil War occurred and we were able to get free, but were we really free? No, we still was oppressed and we still had to be resilient, and we had to be conscious of what was going on. We weren't really free. We didn't have the same rights as other citizens in America. So we just kept fighting, and eventually we were able to get some, and we were able to continue to gain some rights to push to that goal of ours, which is equality. So I'm just saying that because of the current situation right now, of how resilient we all have to be. You know, a situation where we're home more, we have to fight the urge of always wanting to go out or being in large crowds all the time because of COVID. That's how, of course, a lot of people have gotten sick. People have come together, and we have to sometimes fight that urge. We have to be resilient on that because it is something. We've done that most of our lives, being together, being socializing, but now we have to take a step back, and that's an obstacle. And we're doing that also involves the Black Lives Matter movement and protest. There's been a lot of, every time, you know, we fight, and then there's always been this another police incident where they kill an African American, or, you know, minorities just in this country alone, just being racially profiled, or just being racism towards them. So for us, I should say. So we have to continue to be resilient. We can't keep giving up. We can't give up, because if we do, that's how it's just going to easily slip away in this. People just going to think of it as a trend and think of it, oh, you know, it was just a trend. It wasn't something for the long term, but no, this is something for the long term. We have to keep going if we want to fight for the top goal, which is equality. Thanks.
No, thank you, Walter. Thank you for reminding myself and the audience of the importance of resilience and remaining steadfast in our struggle for not just today civil rights, but financial and economic rights. Mr. Harris, I have to ask you to chime in here. Our brother, Walter Pierce, student host, has taken the time to talk about Jesse Jackson. Do you have any questions or comments as it pertains to Jesse Jackson first?
Yeah, because I do remember when he was running for president, you know, and it was, and see, sometimes even in the loss, there's a gain, because what he did was he focused a lot of us, because a lot of us were real kind of apprehensive about voting and stuff like that. He got a lot of people to register to vote. He was able to give a lot of people, you know, just the hope. You know, well, hope was his favorite. That was his favorite word, because his whole thing was, we got to keep hope alive. You know, so, you know, whether we win or lose, the whole idea was keep hope alive. And he was very instrumental in doing that. And, you know, and even like you said before, with Minister Farrakhan's endorsement, you know, he still, you know, he took it all in stride, because he caught a lot of flack for that, you know, but that's just how the American system works. But he caught a lot of flack for that, and he still persevered, and he was definitely resilient, because he ran again in 88.
Is that it?
Oh, well.
Oh, no.
For now,
oh,
yeah.
I mean, no, that's fine, but do you have any comments as it pertains to, it's just the way you had ended. He spoke about Mahalia Jackson, and, you know, you've been doing the curtain segments for a couple of weeks or whatever. What do you any questions or comments as it pertains to Mahalia Jackson?
Yeah, well, yes, because again, the fact that she was from New Orleans, because we were talking about Whitney Marsalis earlier today. He grew up in New Orleans. She was born in New Orleans. There's a lot of our American music that was kind of had its genesis in those little bayou areas. And everybody who kind of got a piece of that in them was always going around the world doing other stuff that pertained more to social issues as much as it was, you know, musical. Because, again, Louis Armstrong was from New Orleans. You know, there was a lot of people that was out there, and she just had that voice that, like you said, if anybody ever heard her sing and you didn't feel something in your spirit change, something wrong with you. Something's wrong with you. She was very instrumental in doing that. And that was a good thing. And the fact, I really love his definition, because as far as people of color have been in this country has done everything for us not to be here. They did everything. They tried to wipe us out, but we were resilient. And we understood that there was more than just what it is now. We've never been a give up. You know, our march might not be all in the same direction, but we all felt like it was going to be better in the future for our children. And that was always been our focus. It's been the future. And you can't make it to the future unless you're resilient. And this country has done everything from chattel slavery through Jim Crow, through black codes, through segregation, redlining. They've done everything to knock us down, but we've been resilient, and we've been able to, like, bring all that stuff and excel in a lot of areas where we shouldn't even be in. Those are very good pieces this morning.
Okay. No questions for Walter.
Well, there are some questions, you know, as far as motivation. You know, he kind of spoke on it a little bit. But, the people are important, but resilience is just a verb. It's something that you have to do. You have to be resilient. And what prompted you to bring that word into our lexicon for today?
I was actually going to, like, explain it later, but I'll explain it now. You know, for a segment I was going to do later, which is talking generally about the NBA and what they're doing right now, what they're going through with this boycott situation and protest. I was trying to relate that with that segment, and how, you know, they're being resilient. They're in the middle of the playoffs, and they were so committed to the situation that they boycotted a game. And they was going to boycott the season if the NBA and others didn't step in and told them they should continue to play. But just them fighting for a cause, being so focused when they're already made it in life, when they already have the movement, still able to relate down to us African Americans. That's silly. That's somebody.
Well, Walter, why don't you transition right into, first of all, give us an update. I know on Wednesday we spoke and we put out a program. And we spoke about the NBA. Just give us some background on the NBA and what they actually did and what they're currently doing right now.
Okay, so for everybody who wasn't here on Wednesday, to recap, basically, Wednesday, it was supposed to be a game. It first started off, it was supposed to be a game between the Milwaukee Bucks and the Orlando Magic. The Milwaukee Bucks stayed in their locker room. They were supposed to come out for warm-up, and the Magic were on the court. So then the Magic went to their locker room, and they officially announced that they were boycotting this game in relation to the shooting of Jacob Blake. So they boycotted that game, and I believe that motivated other teams to boycott their games. So the games that was scheduled for Wednesday and Thursday, all the playoffs were all canceled. The players were boycotted. Now, fast forward a little bit, the Bucks, of course, they released a statement to the press saying why they did this. And the Lakers and Clippers announced that they were going to boycott the rest of the playoffs, and they were not going to play for the rest of the playoffs. That's what they announced. And later, I believe it was either a day later or a couple hours later, they said they were going to continue the play. And, you know, I was just looking, and there's just a lot of people who are just hating on what they're trying to do. Like, it's people saying, oh, you already made it. Like, how are you being depressed? Oh, why are you caring about this? Just play basketball. But no, the only reason this movement is going to be successful is because people like NBA players and people who've made a way in their life is speaking up, and that speaks a lot, and that moves the move. That's what's going to keep moving the movement. People of high stature who already made it in life, speaking on these type of issues. That's what's going to continue the movement. That's why they're doing it. And at first, I thought the NBA told the Lakers and Clippers, "Y'all have to play. Y'all have to continue to play this play." But what I found, which was very interesting, shout out to CNN. They had they released an article saying that Chris Paul is the leader of the players union, reached out to Barack Obama, and along with a couple other NBA players were in that call, including LeBron James and others. They called Obama to seek advice on what they should do, because they're really trying to make a difference, and they need help in this time. And basically, Barack Obama actually told them to continue the season and to use the rest of the season, as a platform to continue to speak on racial issues and to continue this movement on the court. All the action, everything they're doing, this deals with that, so people who watch the game won't forget. We'll continue to know what we're fighting. And I like the idea. I like both ideas of it. You know, there's also some people who believe that everybody should just leave the bubble, which is in Orlando, Florida, and just not play the rest of the season. I get both sides. I actually like both sides. And the reason I'm with both sides is, one, I like the idea of playing, and the people who watch basketball, which is a lot of people in America, a lot of people across the world who watch basketball, different cultures and ethnicities, this is always going to be in their face. They're always going to be able to see what's actually happening and why we are fighting for the situation. And then, on the other hand, leaving the bubble not playing is also another great idea, because that's what triggers losing money. And, you know, a lot of the riches, of course, the top people, executives, the elite, if they lose money, they hate that. They hate losing money. So doing that will force them, I guess, the NBA players to have more say in what they want, so that they could continue back playing. You know, they could call for the rest of the office of Jacob Blake, Breonna Taylor, et cetera. And, of course, this will cause these things to move a little bit quicker, because they're going too slow. This should have already happened, and it hasn't happened. So that will cause them to want this idea of, we have the rest of these offices to actually happen. And, you know, I just applaud the NBA. And it's not only the NBA. It's also the WNBA. They boycotted their games. And Major League Soccer, they boycotted their game. I know it was teams who did that, and baseball, it was a couple teams who did that. I don't have the exact teams who did it, but I know it was a handful of teams who boycotted their games. They came on the court, they came on the baseball field. They took a moment of silence and went back to their bullpen and went back to their locker room and just canceled the game. So what I'm saying is this issue is really moving in the sports world. The sports world is really taking on this issue head first and making sure that everybody gets the message of what we're trying to achieve. And also, I want to mention, even though the NFL has the start of the season, the college, Oklahoma State, their coach, who was Lincoln Riley, he led a protest. He led a march of all his NFL players, and I believe they marched on their campus, and he gave a little message. Coach K of Duke gave a message also, and NFL teams around the country, they all gave messages. They all wore things on their jerseys and their apparel that shows the names of the people that we are fighting for and the cause that we are fighting for. I know the Saints did that, and also the Steelers, Coach Mike Tomlin, he also addressed the situation. He gave a speech. You know, I just believe, like, once the NFL also starts, I believe it's going to continue with them. I think they're going to be head first on the situation. I believe we're going to get a lot of sports doing this. Some, you know, it's going to be a handful. They're not going to be able to do this, but the main sports that people watch and actually obtain, like, different cultures and ethnicities that watch these type of sports, there's always going to be an efficient. We're going to start to realize why we're doing this and how important this is, because you have people who are millionaires who have already made it, who've made their dream come true, still worrying about their people that are struggling, going through these things every day. And that's what's going to push the goal. So thank you, everybody.
Okay. That's a lot there. I have to, without any hesitation, go back to Mr. Harris. Mr. Harris, you know, oftentimes I look at sports in a gladiator sense, where we are able to deaden the crowd noise, weaken the awareness of the public by giving them sports. And when sports and the actual, not gladiators, but the actual athletes get out there and perform, you know, and they actually say, okay, we're going to boycott, something similar to what Colin Kaepernick did. It sends a different type of message, and we've gotten reverb from that. What is your take?
Yeah, well, I was listening to, like, what Walter was saying. The two important words I got out of that was platform and influence. Because just like you said, everybody looks at sports, some kind of sports, at one time or another. And they look up to these individuals as, quote-unquote, gladiators. But these are also their heroes. And most of these people are very wealthy. And matter of fact, in the NBA, if you just took all the salaries of all the brothers in the NBA, they're one of the most richest people in the world as a group. And in this country where money talks, they have an influence over some things that just the average person is not going to have. You know, and their owners, they make money by making sure that the athletes do what they have to do. And they have a power amongst themselves because they talk these poor cities who don't have enough to feed their people to build these extravagant stadiums for these sports folks, payers' money. So if you have enough influence to do that, you can use your same influence in the political arena if you wanted to, because the only thing that people really care about is the stoppage of money. If you're going to do something that's going to affect the money that's coming into my pocket, I will listen to you. But again, like Walter was saying, why the NBA people went to Barack Obama is one thing to have somebody's attention, and it's another thing to have something to say once you get their attention. And right now, the NBA players have gotten the attention, but now they have to have a platform. Chris Webber has been like talking about a lot of this stuff lately, and he's really kind of articulate about what needs to be done, how we need to go about it. We got to stop being emotional and just reactionary about a lot of things that's going on, and we have to start having a plan in hand when we have the platform to be able to express our opinions. And these things like this have a chance. Now, granted, nobody gets everything. That's just the way life is. So, but you can always get something. And you have to add those little steps. And then before you know it, you know, you went a long way just taking one step at a time. You're not going to make big jumps. So, you know, this is a real pivotal point in our struggle. Even, you know, you got most of the people are out in the street. Most people, whether they like the situation or not, are cognizant about what's going on in this country. And matter of fact, around the world, this is not just an American problem. This is a problem that's going on around the world with people of color and the dominant society trying to flex their muscles because they see things are trying to change. So this is just the beginning. And like Langston Hughes was talking about back during the Depression, that it has to be time for people, the common people who have similar issues, to come together and be able to do something to make America stand up to its creed that all men are created equal. And it's not like we're asking for anything more than anybody else. We're just asking that you just make everything the same for everybody. And it's been going on for a while. It's going to go on for a while. Thank God Walter's kind of getting it at his age. So by the time his kids or stuff start asking questions to pop, you know, he'll be able to tell them, well, this is what we did when I was your age. And then the struggle continues. That's all you can say. The struggle is going to continue.
There's a lot of things protests going on. There's a lot of protests going on. And, you know, I'm going to say it like this. If somebody, you know, tries to break into my apartment or somebody tries to rob me, I'm calling 911. I'm calling the police, right? But people are in an uproar because there is a phrase. People come up with phrases without even understanding what they mean. Could you please, Mr. Harris, tell the people what defund the police really mean?
Well, from my perspective, I think defund the police means that the finances and the monies and stuff that are put in to keep the status quo the way the police system is now has to change. You know, police have a specific job in the community. Every time something happens, no matter what it is, if there's a fire, people call the police before they call the fire department. If there's a domestic issue or stuff in the house, people call the police. If there's a cat up in a tree and somebody's nervous, people call the police. They're not trained to take care of all of these outside situations. And they really need, and now that they've become very militarized, you know, there's a lot of funds that could be redirected into areas where we can fix other things that will help shore up the facts, shore up the other areas where police aren't necessarily needed. And it might look as if you're taking something away from the police, but actually you're strengthening their whole program. And the word defund, you know, anything that has to do with money, and it makes it look like you're taking away your money here in America, is going to be an issue. And like you said, a lot of people not having listened to the definitions that people like Walter, when they talk about different words, every word has more than one meaning. Defund don't mean let's get rid of cops. It means let's strengthen the system of policing to the point where it's beneficial for everybody. That's what I think about it.
Oh, okay. Well, I thank you very much because, you know, we live in a time where everyone has a presence on social media, and everyone wants to, you know, say their say, have their say on social media platforms without doing any type of research or doing any type of background, knowing any, speaking totally out of context. And from time to time, as I flip through social media, like we all do, it's hair pulling. That being said, I'd like to invite our guests that are on the line, and they've been on the line for an hour. So we're going to start with 7035. Please introduce yourself and tell us what you thought about today's show and any other comments that you might have. 7035, go for it.
Good morning, gentlemen. It's Valerie, and it was a wonderful show.
It's our number one supporter, Val.
But, I mean, I was really, really, really engaged in the conversation this morning. Very, very good job, Walter, and of course, Mr. Harris, Mr. Bay. But I, when I first listened to the show this morning, I was just like knocked off my feet. Chadwick Boseman died. I did not know that. Oh, my goodness. What a wonderful talent we have lost.
Right. Okay. We're going to move right along to 1295. Please introduce yourself and tell us what you thought about today's show. One, two, nine, five. I think that's our caller from North Carolina. Are you there?
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you.
Okay, I thought the show was awesome. My name is Karen Duke, and I was invited to this program by Val. And I watched Walter as he was a younger kid coming down to his grandmother in North Carolina. But I can tell you, I am so impressed with this. This is so informational, so informative. So thank you so much for this program. And may God continue to bless you all.
Tell us your name again.
Karen Reed.
Oh, well, thank you, Karen. We appreciate you.
And thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so now I'm going to conclude the show, and I'm going to say, in 1941, A. Philip Randolph calls for a march, and in 1954, Brown versus Board of Education, and it's a landmark case to end segregation in education. Unfortunately, in 1955, in August, this particular weekend, 65 years ago, Emmett Till is murdered. at the age of 14 years old. This weekend marks the 57th anniversary of the March on Washington in 1963. And Al Sharpton said to the audience, it's dedicated, and the phrase is, get your knee off our neck. It's time for change. And that change happens through boycott, through march, through participation, education, motivation. But it does not start by sitting on your butt. Okay? So for everybody and our number one supporter who always encourages us to remember that November is the time that we can get out and vote, and we talked about voting. It's not just for a presidential election. There are questions that pertain to our community and our neighborhood on that same ballot. There are people who are practicing apathy and giving all types of reasons, whether it's Democrat or Republican. Aggressively, I say, get your behinds out and vote. If you want to make a change, all politics is local. I might sound like I'm angry, but I'm not. Just a fired up, strong, positive voice. And with that being said, QuestYouth Radio, everybody, is what?
The best youth radio.
All right. You better believe it. And that ends this particular episode. I want to thank our student host, Mr. Harris, our number one supporter, our caller from North Carolina, Karen, and everyone else who is listening to this podcast. Thank you once again, and be sure to tune in again. And I might remind you, we'll be back on the air September 12th, broadcasting live from Seton Hall University. Peace.